people used to ask me, how important is STEM to NASA? I said, it's very important, but so is legal, HR, finance. We need all those skills to allow us to get to be able to do what we were able to do. I mean, facilities folks that keep the temperature in the buildings right? It takes the entire team.
Welcome to Management Matters, a National Academy of Public Administration podcast where policy meets practice. I'm Terry Gurdon, president of the Academy. This month, as we focus on recognizing and honoring public service, I'm chatting with some of our Academy fellows who've had amazing careers. In this episode, I'll be talking with Dr. Robert Lightfoot about his experiences working for the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, or NASA. Robert, thanks so much for joining me today.
It's great to be here, Terry.
So, Robert, you started as a test engineer at NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center, and you spent your entire federal career at NASA. What prompted you to take that very first job?
Well, when I was coming out of the University of Alabama, I had an opportunity to work in the space industry. And the job boards at the university had you know, all these positions available for working on the space shuttle program and areas like that that were very interesting to me as an engineer. And in January of 1986, we lost the Challenger. We had the Challenger explosion and the Challenger tragedy, and the entire job boards just disappeared, right? Everything went away. And I was lucky enough to actually be picked by a company, Rockwell International, to join the redesign efforts after the Challenger accident. So that first couple years that I was out of college, I watched this just incredibly dedicated team, you know, do everything they could to recover from that tragedy, which I didn't have as much of a visceral engagement as they did, but just to see that team was incredible. So they went through the whole process of recovery. We got to the launch, and because of the work I had done, one of the folks at NASA actually said, you know, I'd like to really hire you one day and bring you in to the agency. And so I joined NASA in 89, about 3 years after I had graduated, and was immediately put on a test stand. And honestly, Terry, I didn't even think about it being public service at the time, right? I was working for NASA, and it was just it was being part of an incredible mission and working on the test stands. And I can't explain the feeling I had as a young engineer getting to be involved with testing space shuttle main engines and things like that. But that was what got me going and got me started was really seeing the dedication to the mission. And frankly, I saw that my whole career, right? I would say that's a tenet of being in public service, right? Is that dedication to the mission, whatever your mission is, whatever organization you work for.
Absolutely. And Robert, you bring up such an important point. I mean, when we talk about public administration, I think the typical vision of a public administrator is somebody sitting in a cubicle, you know, working on bureaucracy. But there are so many opportunities for science and technology experts to be part of public service. And we really don't think about it that way. When did it finally dawn on you that this kind of science work was, in fact, public service?
For me, it was really later in my career. I know that sounds strange, but I think when I used to call it being in the colonies, right? I was working in Huntsville and Huntsville, Alabama, and it's Dennis, Mississippi. You know, I really wasn't in Washington, D.C. And most people think, you know, federal employee, you're Washington, D.C. But you think about the park rangers and all these folks that are all over the country. I mean, medical clinics, just everywhere, right? They get to do these things. For me, being an engineer, it got back to that point of hey, we've got a mission to do for the nation. And again, because we had such a mix of industry with us, right? It was a very blended team between civil servants and industry teams to get these shuttles flying. It was more I was part of the shuttle program than I was a government employee, right? Mm-hmm. Now, later in my career, Terry, it became very clear that I was a government employee when I came to Washington, D.C., the last part of my career, and, you know, visiting the White House, meetings at the White House, meetings or having to testify on the Hill. It becomes very clear very quickly what your role is and what you're doing. So, yeah, that for me, it was, again, you get so mission focused, you just don't even think about, you know, what you're doing from that standpoint. But for engineers and scientists, that's what NASA is. I mean, there's a lot of other folks as well, but that's what we're looked at as an agency.
Well, and you mentioned that commitment to mission. NASA repeatedly comes out on the top of the annual best places to work in government, and they're on the top again this year. So you spent the majority of your career there. What's their secret? Is it just mission attachment, or are there other characteristics in that organization that drive employee satisfaction?
Well, I think the main thing is mission, obviously. Charlie Bolden was a former administrator at NASA when I was there as the associate administrator. So I was kind of the top civil servant. And he and the deputy administrator there were political appointees. So we used to talk about this because I got headquarters in 2012 and stayed till I retired in 18. And every year during that time, we were the best place to work. And Charlie and I used to laugh going, well, I wish we could take credit for that, but it's really not us at all, right? It's the culture of the team. It is that mission. And I think we used to talk about, you know, at our agency, we get to make the impossible possible. I mean, you think about things like seeing the Ingenuity helicopter on Mars. You think about those kind of things. We were involved with all that, right? And flying humans to space, these scientific discoveries that we were making, how could you not like to work there? I mean, it's almost that kind of a question. You almost have to flip the question. How could you not like it? And the kind of things we got to do with all our industry partners, and it's just it's a national effort, and in some places, an international effort. So I think that mission just makes other things that would be, I would call it annoyance or distraction, it just makes them go away. And when people are focused on the mission, it's just an incredible thing to watch what folks can actually do.
Well, you know, I think we've seen that even across other agencies over the course of this last year, as, you know, the missions of agencies like the IRS or the Health and Human Services really took front and center stage during the pandemic recovery. Are there lessons from your experience leading NASA as a mission-centered organization that leaders of other agencies might pick up?
You know, what I saw, Terry, was when we had challenges, like we lost Columbia, the Space Shuttle Columbia, the things that I dealt with, the Space Shuttle Columbia going down, Challenger, of course, when I first started working. What I saw was the hierarchy that you kind of think of in any organization, you know, not just government, any organization, it just goes away. You know, we have a problem to solve. And I used to kind of joke that the way the teams would come together and the way I would just call these false walls that get built disappear. In a crisis mode, that's what happens. I mean, it's all hands on deck. Everybody's got to solve the problem. We got to get moving. And a lot of the, it's probably the wrong word, but a lot of the petty stuff goes away, right? It just goes away. And everybody's in, and it really, there's none of this, I'm the boss, you're, you know, it just doesn't happen. Everybody is focused, foresight focused. And that's what I saw in the pandemic, right? You know, from my view now as a citizen, not a public servant. You know, I watched, you know, the government really try and the dedication that was there. We have a big problem to solve and we need to go that. And by the way, you watched, it was a very similar to what I had at NASA in that it was a mix of civil servants and industry, right? To try to get us to a solution here for that problem. So I think, you know, I used to joke at NASA, I wish we were in crisis mode all the time. And it was a joke, by the way. It was a joke. Because in crisis mode, so many of the little, I don't know what to call them, but the things that would distract you at times, they just went away, right? Because people were so focused. And so I think that's the thing you can learn is you don't want to be in crisis mode, but how do you harness that, right? How do you harness the imagination, the innovation all the time of your team, not just when you're in a crisis mode?
And that's a great point. And I think maybe just as a highlight or a corollary to that, scientists and engineers and tech folks really are thinking about problem solving, but the folks who aren't scientists and engineers can think about problem solving as well. And so maybe lifting up the more conventional administration functions to that idea of problem solving and innovation can help drive that mission accomplishment as well.
I chuckle because people used to ask me, how important is STEM to NASA? It's very important, right? Very important. But so is legal, HR, you know, finance. We need all those skills to allow us to get to be able to do what we were able to do. I mean, facilities folks that keep the temperature in the buildings right. Some of these are civil servants as well, right? And you've got it takes the entire team. It's not just while we were looked at as obviously a science and engineering organization. I mean, some of my best memories are with my, especially some of my comms folks, and I'm not throwing that out there just for the comms folks, but I mean, they taught me so much, right? In terms of how do we message what we're trying to do? The accountants keeping me straight. Goodness gracious, you know, anything. I didn't want to nun McCurdy, so I had to go on the Hill to testify, right? So the accountants were really, really, really important to me from that standpoint to keep us straight financially, because we're stewards of the taxpayer dollars, right? We had to make sure we're doing that. And that's tough for engineers sometimes to think about it that way. And with a basis in engineering, that was one of the challenges I had. And so you begin to appreciate all the skills that we need to run, not just this organization. I see the same thing at Lockheed Martin, right, where I am now. And it's just that focus on mission and the fact that the teams are everybody, right? It's not just the science and engineering. You need everybody to make it work.
That's a great point. There are several threads in that answer that I want to pull out. One, thinking about this shift from technical expert to agency leader. I mean, you rose through the ranks all the way from a test engineer all the way up to acting administrator of the whole organization. Where in that process did you feel that transition from technical expert on the launch pad, as you said, to manager or leader? How did that happen?
It's a kind of a funny story. Of course, I had it all planned out just that way, Terry. I want you to know it's perfectly planned. I'm teasing. That's what I tell a lot of the early career folks that ask me this. Or I said, you know, look, I said yes a few times when I probably should have said no. And other people like bosses said yes a few times when they probably should have said no instead of bringing me on. But there was actually a true moment for me. I had grown up running testing engines on the test stand. And there was a time where it became obvious that the work was slowing down where I was. We needed to be able to get more work. And I know that sounds weird as a government employee trying to go get more work, but we were trying to see who else needed our services, right? And so it became very clear that I was somewhat of an extrovert, right? As opposed to the normal folks on my team. And I became the person that got called a lot to go do certain presentations, to do tours when people came in. And I realized there was a value I had if I wanted to do it. And that was part of the question. If I wanted to move from my technical part to more of a management or leadership position, I could probably do that, right? But I'll tell you, the last test I ran, man, I knew it was my last one because I knew I was getting ready to take on a new role. It was probably one of the most emotional events I had in my career, because I knew I was making that decision and I was leaving what I just absolutely loved. And that fear of leaving what I loved actually turned into a new passion, right, around leadership and management that I was able to do, and frankly, loved what I was doing in my next role too, right? So, you know, as long as you've got that passion around what you're doing, you can adjust. But I will tell you, that was I can remember the moment after the test was over. I was kind of by myself up on the test stand, and I just, this test stand's like 300 feet tall, right? So I'm something like 100 feet in the air, just looking out over the tops of the trees. And I just kind of went, that was it. That was my last test. And oh, it was tough. That was tough for me to deal with. But you know what? It was tough for me when I left the agency as well, right? To join Lockheed Martin. It was one of those cases where I moved on, and here I am. I'm finding the same kind of passion and joy at Lockheed Martin that I had there. Same kind of things.
Yeah, that's a wonderful story about, you know, leaving one path behind and choosing another. How did you learn the leadership and management skills that would be so critical to your success? I mean, we typically think that there's some training or some magical, you know, brain implant that will give you the leadership and management skills coming from a technical background. How did you make that transition?
It was pretty easy for me, I think, because I've always been one of those that I don't say I'm insecure, but I've had an inferiority complex where I didn't really think I deserved whatever I got, right? And so it was pretty easy for me to go, okay, I'm now in this position. I've got to really, it's almost like you got to overperform, right? To prove to myself that I could do it. But as far as leadership and management goes, I had one role model, my dad. My dad was a school teacher, which in my opinion is a public servant, right?
Absolutely.
And he was at a university, and my dad treated everyone the same. Everyone. I mean, it does not matter who you were. he just treated them all the same. And I watched that as I was growing up. And to me, that became, it just became kind of my leadership style, is that is I'm serving you more than you're serving me, right? And everybody's important. Every member of the team is important. And we better make sure they're all being included. We better make sure they're all engaged, right? Or we won't get our mission done, right? And the diversity of thought that comes from a very diverse team allows you to have a better solution. I mean, I watched my dad do this, right? And the other thing that my dad taught me was, you better love what you're doing, right? And as long as you love what you're doing, it won't be work, right? And I know that's a trite statement. We've all heard that, but it's so true. So to me, I wanted to make sure not just that I loved what I did, but the folks that worked for me did too, right? And so, pretty basic, I guess I would just call it foundational things I learned from my dad, right? Or probably allowed me to make that transition and make it fairly easily.
Our perspective on servant leadership is so important as a motivation for the folks who work for us. So I really appreciate you sharing that story. More systematically, does NASA as a science-based agency have a particular approach to professional development? Does it reach down and choose technical experts and train them for those leadership positions? Or is it sort of accidental, the folks like you who find their way to those leadership positions?
We have a very good program at NASA for developing folks. And I think part of it is the recognition that a lot of science and engineers probably didn't get that kind of training in school. I will say universities now are doing a lot better job of that, emphasizing team building, emphasizing cross department kind of projects, right? So you get used to working with the business school. So when I was in school, that was not the way it was, right? And so NASA had multiple tiers of training. It had early career kind of programs you could get into that your supervisor, if they saw a spark, might sponsor you for that, right? There was mid-level leadership program. And then there was, the Senior Executive Candidate Development Program, the CDP, that most folks know about, and multiple other opportunities in there for particular classes. So I was very fortunate that I was able to take advantage of some of those. In some cases, I was, offered coaching, which was really important. And by the way, I get that at Lockheed Martin, even as a vice president. I mean, it just shows you Lockheed Martin finds that important as well, right? Even when you, as I told my coach, I said, even when you hear at Lockheed Martin, that even when I thought I'd had all the coaching I could have, I'm still learning, right? And I think that's an important thing for all of us, right? Is we just got to keep learning. But NASA had really good opportunities for that, for training. And frankly, some of them were NASA and some of them were, OPM. They ran it at the higher level, and you could do both. So, I took as much advantage of that as I could. Again, always trying to learn.
Well, I think, you've shared with us a lot of things that go into that best places to work: leadership, commitment to mission, training and development, opportunities to be part of really big projects that all collectively make it such a compelling organization. NASA is really at the forefront of another area, and you mentioned it earlier, which is their partnership with industry. That's been a kind of a growing space where NASA is really partnering with lots of private industry now to reshape the space mission. What insights do you have from your experience there that could help other folks in civil service look more at public-private partnerships, think about these as innovations in terms of how they accomplish their mission?
Yeah, I think when I was there, it was in the late 2005, 2006 timeframe, we started thinking about how can we leverage maybe new people, new entrants, new companies into the same fold that we already have. We already had many of the traditional industry in there. And so we were looking at ways to encourage innovation, because we felt like one of our missions at NASA was to develop industry, right, in the United States. And so we had some great opportunities there to help us get our mission done. As long as you keep that mission front first, right, and say, who can help us get our mission done? And have a little bit of a, ability to take maybe not a lot of risk, but a little more risk, right, than you normally would do, recognizing that some of that's not going to work out, right? That's the whole way you look at it. So we took that risk and we were fairly successful. And now you look at the industry landscape that's dealing with space, and the way it's a way of helping you get your job done, right? Get your mission done. And it's funny, Terry, I've taken that to Lockheed Martin. with me, that same spirit, and you'll see we're investing in smaller companies. We're using them to get part of our mission done here. So it's what I learned, right, at NASA is it is pretty effective. And so ABL, a small launch company, we're dealing with here at Lockheed Martin, and I wouldn't have probably even thought about that if I hadn't done what we did at NASA when I was there. So I think that, but I think that's part of our role as civil servants, right, is to really, you know, get the next industry going. What is that next industry? And there's a lot of investment in that industry that we can take advantage of. And we're doing the same thing here at Lockheed Martin now in this role. So it's another way. It's one of those kind of places where you open your aperture and you say, okay, what's a different way for us to get this mission done? Right. And that's what we were able to do.
And I'm just curious, you know, NASA started as a scientific exploration agency, and now we're envisioning an entire commercialization of the space sector. What do you see as the future?
I would say the future is pretty wide open. I know there's so many opportunities there, and we've become, you know, you think about what we as a nation, heck, internationally, not just as the U.S., but globally, we've become so dependent on space. And I don't think the general public actually understands it, right? I was given a speech. Lockheed Martin just launched one of their GPS satellites, the kind of the next one in the constellation. And I happened to be given a speech that about it, and saw this during my NASA days too. It's just people just don't understand how much they depend on space. And so I was talking about, we had just launched it, and someone said, "Why do I need a GPS satellite? I have maps on my phone." and I said, I told that story at this speech, and, you know, I would say 80% of the room laughed, right? And I said, for those of you, the 20% that didn't laugh, come see me afterwards. We need to talk, right? Because I'm not sure they understood what we did. And so from that perspective, there's so much on a daily basis we depend on now. And so I think that's one reason, you know, before it was that just getting to space was the hard part, right? Well, now we're in space, and how do we develop that as an economy nationally and globally going forward? How do you turn it into a business, right? And so there's all sorts of opportunity there. We're in the middle of that, with it, whether it's NASA, Department of Defense, or even just commercial applications. That's what we, you know, that was one of my goals for when I left NASA, when I ended up at Lockheed Martin, was it's a very similar mission and a very similar profile, right? So, you know, you just take what you learned when I was as a public servant, and now I'm able to kind of keep doing the mission today. And that's what gets me up in the morning, Terry.
Well, that was actually going to be my next question, right? Sort of a retrospective and a prospective. As you look back over your time at NASA, what would you consider your most significant accomplishments? And as you look forward, what are you looking to be able to accomplish?
Yeah, I think, you know, I could ask that question a few times, and I would say that I always break my NASA career into three phases, right? Early, mid, and late. So I think the early part, you know, from an accomplishment standpoint was actually being able to lead a team to get the space shuttle main engine to put technology on it that made the main engine safer for flight, right? That was just an awesome thing to be part of. Mid-career, it was being part of the return to flight for Columbia. That was my first trip to Washington, D.C., was to lead the return to flight from headquarters. And it was not a technical job at all. The technical team was doing the thing, but that's when I learned I had to talk about budgets. I had to go see all the committees. I had to go to the White House. And I was like, oh, I didn't realize all this went on. All right. It was my first really, that's kind of the first time I went, okay, I am a civil servant. I got it. I'm not just a shuttle guy in my role, but the fact that we pulled that off and flew successfully and actually ended, you know, as part of my career, probably the end of my mid-year phase was when we closed out the shuttle program. We flew it out safely, right? And that was just so important for us as a team. And then the later part of my career was, you know, really being able to be part of setting the policy. You know, when the Trump administration came in, I was the longest running acting administrator. I think I was 458 days. The closest one was 220, right? And so when you look at that, you know, I kept waiting for Jim Bridenstine to get confirmed. He'd already been nominated, but just to get him confirmed. And so I kept waiting and waiting and waiting, but I didn't have the team wait, right? I told us to keep going. And you know, sitting with Vice President Pence and President Trump and truly just having these conversations around what's the national space policy going to be, and being part of that discussion was probably one of the, And as I said, well, they actually listened to me. That's pretty scary. my dad would joke with me and go, he would say, really, they're listening to you? This, because I'm not sure that's a good thing, right? Because he was always good about keeping my feet grounded, right? But it was that last part of being part of helping them set some of the policy they put in place, you know, was just pretty amazing, you know, to be part of that. And now, as I look forward, I'm on the other side. I'm in industry at Lockheed Martin, and now I get a chance to help NASA. NASA has always been, you know, a mix of industry and civil servant, right? I'm roughly, when I was there, roughly 80 to 85%, depending on the year, of the dollars NASA got went right into industry, right? That was always the way we did it. And now I'm on the side, and we're a trusted partner for many of the government agencies that have just these critically important missions, including NASA. And now I get to do it from this side. And so it's just having both perspectives is fun. And I see what we're going to be able to do. We're going to be able to take humans back to the moon. You know, we're building the Orion spacecraft. And I know, and because I was at NASA, I know exactly why that's important to the total mission, right? We put heat shield that allowed Perseverance to land on Mars. We built several of the deep space exploration spacecraft that are out there now, and we're building even more. And so being part of that from the other side, it's funny because it feels like the same thing, right? I feel like I'm still working for NASA, and I actually am, right, as industry, Lockheed Martin, but the mission's the same, and I see the same spirit in the team here at Lockheed Martin that I saw in NASA. It's all about that mission. So that's what I see going forward. And I think, you know, we used to say the sky's not the limit.
And, wow.
And so it's the same thing, right? We're just going to keep making the impossible possible. And 2 weeks ago, you saw a helicopter fly on Mars. You would have been told that was impossible, right? And yet there it is. We did it. So pretty fun to be part of those kind of, I used to call them when I was at NASA, I said, and I would speak to folks, I would say, how many times do you get to be involved with civilization changing efforts? Right. And if you go back to even when Neil Armstrong stepped on the moon, you read the newspapers that all above the fold, for those of you that remember newspapers, above the fold was that big headline, right? And globally, they all said, we did it. We did it. Not NASA, not the United States, civilization, right? And, you know, one day, I suspect one day we'll find life somewhere else, right? Some sort of form of life somewhere else. And that'll be another one of those moments, right? And we can say we were part of that. I mean, my goodness, that's just, again, why wouldn't you want to get up and go to work in the morning with that kind of a mission?
All right, you've inspired me to think about career change. I do live it a little bit vicariously through my children, one of whom was working for a subcontractor to NASA. So learning a little bit about the software code that goes into satellites and how complex that is, I can appreciate it.
Oh, my goodness. You were exactly right on that.
Yeah.
It is very complex.
Like, I don't understand what you do, but I understand why you do it. So. So let's end there. Tell me what advice you have for those kids who are in engineering schools today and they're thinking about whether or not they should work for the government. What would you tell them? What advice would you give them?
It's very simple, right? Follow your passion. You can come to the U.S. government and be part of a team that's accomplishing things that you'd never be able to accomplish by yourself. I mean, being part of a team that sends people to space, makes these great discoveries, advances technologies that we're not even thinking about, you know, pushes the boundaries of aeronautics. I mean, that's what I saw from a NASA standpoint. You can take the path I took, right? I started in industry and changed over to the government, and now I'm back in industry, right? There's so many opportunities there, but the key is follow your passion, right? And if you want to be part of that, part of a scientific or engineering discipline, you can work public or industry, right? It's not closed off. You're not just an administrator. I got pictures of, I mean, to your point earlier, Terry, you know, sometimes we're just sitting behind a desk as a civil servant. I got photographs of me in blue jeans with hydraulic fluid all over me from where a valve leaked, you know, and as a NASA employee, right? And you kind of chuckle sometimes about that, but that's, that's the real world we were doing, right? We were making things happen, and those opportunities exist in federal service and they exist in industry. But follow your passion. That's all I can tell folks. I told my daughters, I said, make sure whatever you're doing, because my dad told me this, make sure whatever you're doing is something you want to do, because you're going to have to do it a long time. it made a difference for me. I mean, I made selections in positions that I took and places that I moved because of that tenet. So worked out for me. I'm not saying it's going to work out for everybody, but I think it worked out for me okay.
Well, Robert, thanks so much for sharing your wisdom and your passion and your experiences with us today, and for helping us remember that public service can really help in lots of ways to make the impossible possible. And thanks for your service to the country. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Terry. Thanks for having me.
For our listeners, check back every Monday for a new podcast from the Academy. We'll be talking to Academy fellows each week about the challenges facing public administrators at every level of government as we try to make government work and work for all. Thanks for listening.